Court is now ready to hear Ex Parte Tucci and others, original habeas corpus proceedings. The court is ready to hear argument from the late holders.
May it please the court, Mr. J. Seculo will present argument from the late holders.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this case is not about the blockades of abortion clinics or about actions for trespass. Contrary to the repeated assertions by the respondents, this case is about prayer, it is about singing, and it is about legal, lawful free speech activities conducted on public forum sidewalks in the vicinity of the Planned Parenthood clinic.
Well, in that regard, do you concede that each of the relators violated the temporary restraining order?
I do not, Your Honor, because we believe that the conduct of each of the relators is protected activity, both under the Texas Constitution.
That's really not my question, though certainly an appropriate inquiry. But do you concede that by the letter of the restraining order involved here, that each one violated that restraining order?
Certainly by the definition of demonstration issued by Judge O'Neill, where she clearly said on numerous occasions that by engaging in group prayer and singing, it constitutes a demonstration, yes.
Did any of these violations involve blocking the access to any of the facilities in question?
No, it did not, Your Honor.
Could you describe how the TRO was violated?
The TRO in paragraph 2 prohibits demonstrations within 100 feet of the Planned Parenthood clinic, actually the listed clinics in this particular case. The TRO creates a 100-foot speech-free zone surrounding these particular abortion facilities. The trial court, Judge O'Neill, stated quite succinctly during the contempt proceedings that the term demonstration would include, without question, prayer and singing and political speeches. So that is where the interpretation of the term demonstration came from. In fact, Judge O'Neill stated that the definition of demonstration, as set forth in a dictionary, would violate the court's order. She stated that the term demonstration, if she utilized the dictionary, that would be prohibited by her order, would be a public display of group feelings toward a person or a cause. That order, yes, Your Honor.
Is it your contention, then, that the only way in which this restraining order was violated was having a demonstration, whatever that involved, a protest, within an area closer to the facility than 100 feet?
Yes. That is the position that not only that has been litigated in the case, but that is the position and the facts of the case support.
And wasn't there also a question about sound amplification?
There was some statements regarding sound amplification, but the charges of contempt that are before the trial court here involved the prayer activity, the singing activity, and the peaceful protest activities. There is no question. In fact, the witnesses testified that there was quite a bit of commotion going on in the area, but that was not solely because of these particular relators engaging in conduct demonstration activities. It was because of those that were opposed to the relators' view being speaking out as well, which they have the right to do under both the Texas Constitution and the U.S. Constitution.
So is the only question we really face whether that 100-foot area in the restraining order constitutes a valid time, place, and manner restraint on expression?
The issue, Your Honor, is whether that the order, yes. We don't take the posture, however, that a valid time, place, and manner restriction can be instituted for proceedings as they were here in this TRO. And specifically, even if a temporary restraining order drafting what was perceived to be a time, place, and manner restriction, I think clearly within that 100-foot zone, the expression, the demonstrations, cannot take place at any time, in any manner, or in any place within that 100-foot zone. And that 100-foot zone clearly covered public sidewalks, places that the Supreme Court and this Court have said are traditional public forum places open for expression. Interestingly, I believe, this Court's discussion in Ex parte Henry, dealt with the issue of a 100-foot ban with regard to striking. It was a picketing involving a strike in the railway area, and there was a requirement issued by a court that the 100-foot ban be instituted so that no picketing take place within this 100-foot zone there. This court struck that down as unconstitutional under the Texas, actually they're utilizing the First Amendment, to the U.S. Constitution, but held, and I think importantly so, that this court first could reach the issue of the constitutionality of, or unconstitutionality of, the particular order. That is, the underlying order could be reached, both on its face and as applied to the facts, because this court has not adopted the collateral bar rule, which would prohibit, if the collateral bar rule would be adopted, and on its face, as applied review of the constitutionality of the injunction. This court has not adopted the collateral bar rule. And this court has reviewed injunctions in the process of a habeas proceeding. Here, and I think properly, this court in Henry stated that one, utilizing the Schneider versus State case, one could not have his liberty of speech abridged on the plea that it could take place in some other forum, in some other place. That is exactly what's happened here. In the guise of regulation, free expression has been eliminated in this public forum. This is not a time, place, and manner restriction. This is a ban on public forum properties, very similar to the ban that the U.S. Supreme Court was faced with in United States versus Grace.
Could there be a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction in these circumstances?
There are reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, Your Honor. For instance, the ordinances of Houston and the county involved prohibit blockading, prohibit interference and hindrance with pedestrian traffic. Those provisions already exist.
Well, then, to be more precise, can a restraining order be fashioned in such a way that it is a valid time, place, and manner restriction rather than an absolute ban such as that which you say exists here?
I think that the role of the legislature is to adopt ordinances with regard to time, place, and manner, not a court through a temporary restraining process, order process. However, even if the
case court law that supports the authority that a judge has less
There is not. Absolutely is not. We've maintained the position from Allison. It's clearly in our briefs that we don't believe courts should have that authority. That is a process for the legislature. I do not have a case to support that. But I think there is a legitimate underlying reason why that makes sense.
Well, and you also cite in your briefs cases that you distinguish in which restraints were placed on expression through the injunctive process of a court, don't you?
The cases that we rely on, for instance, the case we most strongly rely on is the Fifth Circuit's opinion in Mississippi Women's Health Clinic versus McMillan, where the court refused to issue a 500-foot injunction. The respondents have brought forth cases in the Third Circuit, most specifically in McMonagle, where they allege that there was this 500-foot ban instituted by an injunction. However, we noted this in our briefs, in that case, even the court there, we think was an unconstitutional order, allowed six demonstrators within that area. The Georgia Supreme Court also has dealt with this issue.
What about the Supreme Court's ruling in May of this year in Burson, where they held that the state of Tennessee could impose a 100-foot limit at its polling places?
That was by statute, and we think that the court there, the analysis would be helpful to our case. In the first instance, the court did agree that the sidewalks where the activities would have taken place were traditional public forum properties. The court then applied the compelling interest test to see if the justification on the ban could be supported under a compelling interest test. Justice Blackmun, speaking for the majority of the court, stated quite clearly that normally, because of the compelling interest test, these type of restraints don't meet constitutional scrutiny. It did in the case of voting because of the unique history of voter influence and the ability for free voting. That was the compelling interest. Here, the justification for the prohibition does not meet the compelling interest test. In fact, the justifications have been rejected by courts. Other courts throughout the country have rejected the justifications. Booz versus Berry, which the respondents have relied upon, a decision out of the United States Supreme Court, dealt with an ordinance that prohibited the congregation of people within 500 feet of an embassy. That was challenged. And the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, in reviewing the congregation clause in Booz versus Berry, held, and we think quite properly, narrowly construing the statute to say it doesn't mean no people with no demonstrators within the 500-foot zone. Rather, what it means is that no activity that will interfere with the ongoings of the facility, there was an allowance made for that. You could have congregations that did not interfere with the facility, and the same is true in Grady. Yes, sir.
Is it your position that a court, through a restraining order, can never impose a time, place, and manner restriction, even to prevent blockading access to one of these facilities?
No, that is not our position, Your Honor.
So it's a question of degree, isn't it, as to whether this particular restraint was one that was appropriate for limiting expression?
Not in the sense that, with regard to the blockading of the facilities, there the trial court is basically enforcing, through its temporary restraining order, those ordinances which already exist to prohibit blocking. And if the court were to adopt, in the guise of a time, place, and manner regulation, assuming arguendo for those purposes, they could prohibit the blockading of egress and ingress on sidewalks, for instance. But you can't create a speech-free zone.
Well, are you continue to tie it to legislative action. Are you suggesting that if this were a facility in an unincorporated area, a court could not employ a restraining order to prevent blockading and trespass on a facility?
No, I understand what Your Honor is saying. Unless you're assuming that there's unlawful activity there, of course they can. But what's at issue here, and what makes this case different from the example, is the court on its own imposed this restraint. And even if we were to concede that a time, place, and manner restriction could be adopted through the injunctive process, for instance, in an unincorporated area where they weren't able to utilize legislative process, even there, this restriction does fall. And I think that's extremely significant here.
Counsel, can a court order like this involving an injunction, temporary restraining order here, ever be content neutral as opposed to an ordinance which might prohibit any demonstrations within 100 feet?
Well, from a procedural standpoint, it cannot be content neutral because it restricts only those that are deemed to be in violation of the order, those covered by the order. So some people could go within that 100-foot area and carry on activities. The argument here is that it's not content-based because these demonstrators could not go within the area to quote, demonstrate, sing, pray, conduct free speech type activities. They could say anything. That points more to the fact that this is not a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. This is a ban. Yes.
Counsel, what do you say would have been a reasonable zone?
I think that if there was evidence submitted at trial that would have shown that these particular individuals were blockading the clinics, that certainly keeping the area open in front of the clinic for access, those people that wanted to get in the door of the clinic, those would be a restriction. However, this restraining order prohibits people from being across the street, and in fact, viewing the topography requires them to be buildings away. Actually, the 100-foot zone is broader than 100 feet. So there are precedents which keep open what I call windows or triangles 12 feet in front of a particular door.
Well,
but that's not what's here.
As we look at that evidence, surely the judge does not have to wait until the facility has been blockaded or trespassed upon or people have been denied the right of access to the facility before acting.
Well, with due respect, I think the court would not be able to just issue a temporary restraining order without evidence. And here, I think it's equally clear that those that were deemed to be violating the order, and Judge O'Neill herself stated, the trial court stated themselves, what was at stake here. And she stated that by going in that 100-foot zone to pray, to sing, to conduct speech-type activities would violate the order. One of the relators, Bob Jewett, was simply praying. Some press came over to him and spoke with him. He was within the 100-foot zone, oftentimes across the street, and that was still deemed to be a violation of the order.
In ascertaining whether this is an unconstitutional prior restraint, don't we need to review the evidence that the judge had before her at the time that she issued the restraining order?
I think, Your Honor, in the first instance, this court has requested by order copies of the transcripts from all of the proceedings, and those are being delivered. Some of the proceedings, some of the contempt proceedings have been delivered to the court from the clerk's office, is my understanding, but those transcripts are on their way here. Also, under the authority of Walker versus Birmingham, a transparently invalid injunction can be challenged on its face. And here, there's a 100-foot ban on sidewalks, on streets, traditional public forum properties, and there is no justification to prohibit these type of activities. As I said, this is not a blockade. to prohibit these type of activities from taking place on those particular traditional public forums.
I remain unclear as to whether your position is that this order is unreasonable as a time, place, and manner restriction, or is unlawful as a prior restraint, regardless of the reasonability of the restriction.
There's no doubt, Your Honor, that our position is that it is an unlawful prior restraint because it requires or prohibits speech before it takes place. And this court has been even more protective.
But so does an ordinance that you said could be of reasonable restriction.
Yes, Your Honor, but ordinances can also be prior restraints. We have challenged throughout the country many ordinances that we deem to be prior restraints. And a prior restraint is when one, to exercise his, under the Article 1, Section 8 of this state's constitution, liberty to speak, they cannot speak prior to engaging in activity. And that's exactly what you have here. It's as if the liberty to speech stops when someone gets within the 100-foot curb of these traditional public forum properties. And we think this court, who's been particularly careful and protective and zealous in its protection of the liberty to speak and to free speech protections, would even more so construe this type of prior restraint, which is what our position is. This is a classic prior restraint. It prohibits speech before it can take place, as soon as someone walks in the zone. And as I said, I think clearly we must realize that what we're dealing with here is public forum property. One need not have this liberty of speech abridged because it could take place three blocks away. And that's, I think, more so here in this court, in its interpretation of the Texas Constitution, than even the federal courts have. There's another analysis I think that's appropriate, and that is when you have a situation regarding an ordinance that was a time, place, and manner restriction, you have the situation where, for instance, in Graydon versus City of Rockford, where there was a concern that within the confines or the area surrounding public schools, that particular speech activity would somehow violate the rights of those that were inside the school getting an education. There was that conflict, the compelling interest of what they're beginning to do or what was going on in the school and what was taking place outside. But there, Justice Marshall, running for the court, stated that the 100-foot ban, keeping people away, is not a ban of peaceful activity. And interestingly, even if we were to concede that the court could adopt a time, place, and manner restriction, the Georgia Supreme Court in Hirsch versus the City of Atlanta was faced with an injunction in some ways very similar to this. There, the restraint was a 50-foot ban for demonstrations. The position that the case was posturing, there were people that were arrested simply for demonstrating. Prayer again was the issue. When the case was reviewed by the Georgia Supreme Court, in order to uphold the constitutionality of the injunction issued by the trial court, the injunction had to be modified to allow 20 people, that was in their mind the reasonable number, within that 50-foot zone. So this is a complete ban on the activity, where in Hirsch there was modifications to allow the activity. And the same could be said of McMonagle and other cases where the distribution of literature were to take place or the singing and prayer activities were to take place. This is classic speech in the classic forum. And we think it's important to note at the outset that under the First Amendment's principles, the U.S. Constitution, that the First Amendment was supposed to be not a grant of power to government, but a limitation. Fortunately, this court has taken a much more protective view of free speech and free expression.
In that regard, and you referenced, of course, though not by name, our recent decision in Davenport against Garcia, do you believe that that standard and that test that we applied for prior restraints there, declaring such restraints presumptively unconstitutional and saying that they would exist only in extraordinary circumstances, is the appropriate test by which we should review this restraining order?
Yes, we do, and primarily because this court in Davenport versus Garcia utilized in part of its analysis that if the restraint had to be narrowly tailored, utilizing an approach from the time, place, and manner regulations. In this case, and I think it's important, this clearly is not a narrowly tailored regulation of speech. It eliminates speech at its source, at its core, on public forum and public properties.
How do you respond to the counties and the other parties' reliance on Walker, the city of Birmingham, that a relator has to exhaust remedies and obey the lawful processes of the courts and not call press conferences, for example, like one of your clients did in this case, and tear up the TRO? Is the city of Walker, but the city of Birmingham still good law?
It's good law for courts and states that have adopted the collateral bar rule. This court has not. Most recently, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in Zoll versus Steve, there's not a published opinion on it yet, it is a slip opinion at this point, it will be published, dealt with the issue of the applicability of the collateral bar rule. Instead, states may adopt the collateral bar rule, but they need not do so. And here, I think, under the authority of Ex parte Tucker and Ex parte Henry, this court wisely has chosen not to, because there's an affirmative protection on speech under the Texas Constitution. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, respondents will be represented by Mr. Rock Owens and Mr. Neil Manning. Ms. Owens will open, and I may have omitted to mention earlier that Mr. Sekulo did reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm here along with my co-counsel, Terry O'Rourke, as assistance to the Honorable Harris County Attorney Mike Driscoll, who represents the named respondent in this case, the Sheriff of Harris County, Johnny Cleveland Hayden. As the named parties in this case, we have a singular issue we wish to present to the court this morning, and we have reserved the bulk of the time for the real parties in interest that are represented by Mr. Neil Manning, who sought the temporary restraining and protective order and actually sought the contempt judgments that brought us here this morning. The first question we think that this court should address is the one that's raised by Justice Gonzalez this morning, and that affects our position the most, and that is, should these relators be allowed to deliberately disobey a court order without first seeking some other clarification of that order?
Is it your position, counsel, that someone may be incarcerated for violating an unconstitutional order?
Well, I think that the case law, and I would urge Walker versus Birmingham, would hold that first of all, the individual is not the one that should make the first determination as to whether that order, without first going back to the trial court or without first seeking some sort of appellate clarification, that individual should be the one that should make the first decision to say, the order is unconstitutional, therefore I shall violate it.
Why can't an individual test the constitutionality of the underlying order on by writ of habeas corpus once they're held in contempt, as these relators have?
Well, we feel that, first of all, that would allow individuals in this society to continually test orders without first seeking clarification from the courts. I think that's the rule that's expressed in Walker versus Birmingham, that no man should be a judge unto himself, that first he should seek the authority of law before violating a court order.
Well, that may be the law there, but isn't it totally irrelevant to the state of Texas, which has its own independent jurisprudence and its own decisions on this issue that where we don't have a collateral bar rule?
Well, we don't think that it's totally irrelevant.
You're asking us to change the Texas law then to conform with the federal law?
We're asking both that, and we're asking both to expand what we feel is the law in Texas today, and that's that one may violate a court order where one is unsure, or there is something on its face that creates some doubt as to what one would do, some error in the order or something that would place one in jeopardy by not giving them the decision that they could take in a sort of a catch-22 situation. But here we have a situation, Your Honor, where the court order was issued. The relators in this case, after apparently having some knowledge of what was in the court order, made the determination that they would not be bound by it under any circumstance and that they would violate it.
Well, I have a factual question in that regard. What order do you contend was in effect at the time of the demonstration at Planned Parenthood on August 18th and 19th?
I think the temporary restraining order that had been issued by Judge O'Neill, which banned demonstration within a 100-foot distance of the clinic facility, was in.
Didn't that order on its face provide that it expired when the hearing on the temporary injunction began?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, then how could it have in any way been the basis for contempt against Mr. Terry or Mr. Slavonic for action that they took on the 18th and 19th?
My understanding was the order was renewed by the trial court at the insistence of the relators. They sought a continuance in the case before the trial on the merits. So that order was in effect at the time that those persons, I believe, were charged with contempt. I may be incorrect on that, but I believe that's correct.
Well, some of the confusion over this, of course, is the lack of a complete record, but I would hope that by supplemental letter brief or whatever, you would specifically draw our attention to whatever the basis is that it is alleged, what order it is that those two people violated, because the only order we've got would suggest there was no order in place at that time.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that. There is some lack of clarity on that issue. But to go back to my argument, the county and the sheriff feel that something should have been done by these relators other than just blanketly announcing to the press that they were going to violate this order. We feel that it's a dangerous precedent to set to allow persons in our society to do such a thing. The first thing that they could have done is they could have appealed to the Court of Appeals based on the fact that this order was in effect a temporary injunction. They could have moved for the dissolution of the order. They could have moved for modification of the order. Those things were all done at a later point in the trial. As a matter of fact, I believe a modification was urged in the closing days of the trial on the merits of the temporary injunction. I believe that Reverend Mahoney moved for dissolution of the temporary restraining order actually during his incarceration. We feel that those things should have been sought by the relators before they blanketly violated it.
Has a temporary injunction ever been issued in this case?
No, Your Honor, it has not.
Doesn't that, and the fact that as part of the only record we have is the tape of their press conference where they announce that a principal objective is to find out and to prevent President Bush from avoiding yet another commitment to them on this issue, that the time of this particular demonstration was critical, and that if they felt it was an improper restraint, the only way to test it was to do what they did rather than to go through a lengthy appellate process.
Well, I don't think the appellate process would have necessarily had to have been lengthy to begin with. It could have been an accelerated appellate process. But I think that's the argument that's raised in Walker versus Birmingham is, when did the issue become critical? Could they have waited 1 or 2 days? Could they have gone back to the court and sought a modification or sought a clarification or finalization of the order? They didn't do any of those things. They simply went out without going back to the court at all and violated the court order. And I think one of the things that's important, too, is we need to break these relators probably into categories. We have the first four who had notice of the court order and then went out and violated it. We have the other three who had quite a bit of notice, quite a bit of opportunity. The hearings process dragged on for several weeks before they were found in contempt.
Well, in that regard, let me be sure that I understand, and I'll pose just the same question I did to your opposing counsel. Would you tell us specifically what each of these individuals did that constituted a violation of the court order? And I've already been told that it was only to step within the 100-feet zone.
Well, I would have to give you my opinion of what was the basis for Judge O'Neill's ruling, but I'll be happy to do that.
Why don't you just reflect what the record will show as to the evidence on that issue?
I'd be happy to do so. The evidence would show, I believe, that with regards to the first four, that would be Jewett, Mahoney,
Wright and Benham.
Wright and Benham, yes. That they first of all announced within the 100-foot zone that they intended to violate the court order. They called a press conference within the 100-foot zone and tore up what was purported to be copies of that court order. They then marched to an area that was central to the 100-foot zone, knelt and prayed, got up and left.
So there was no conduct that evidence was offered to suggest that they in any way obstructed access to the facility?
I do not believe there was. No.
How can you defend a restraining order with this 100-foot zone to prevent those kind of expressive activities under the test that this court announced in Davenport against Garcia?
Well, I think Davenport is distinguishable. I think Davenport is a content case. I think all the cases that lead up to Davenport in Texas deal with the content of the speech. The court's order in this case is extremely neutral when it comes to content. It does not talk about religious activity. It does not talk about abortion materials. It simply says there shall be no demonstration by these defendants within this 100-foot zone.
Counsel, how can you contend that this is content neutral when we have the parties identified in the style of the case and obviously the judge taking into account in issuing the restraining order the nature of the activities that were sought to be prohibited by the order? How can that ever be content neutral?
Well, I think that what was sought to be protected here was the rights of the clinics to operate, as well as, at least in the case of the Planned Parenthood Street on Berry, there were several other businesses that joined as interveners in this case that were not related to the specific issue that was being demonstrated about, that was being talked about, and therefore I think that they were content neutral.
Well, you find a distinction in Davenport that I failed to perceive, so let me pose the question this way. If the test applicable to evaluating this prior restraint is that first you have to show that there's an imminent and irreparable harm that will occur to significant interest, and second, you have to show that the judicial restraint involved represents the least restrictive means of preventing that harm, how can this absolute ban within 100 feet stand?
Well, I think that we must first look at what the trial court did, and Judge O'Neill obviously reached the conclusion that there was immediate and irreparable harm. It's so stated in her order.
And what evidence did she have to support that finding?
My understanding is she had affidavit testimony from the applicants.
And that will be forthcoming with the record to us?
I believe it will be.
And we would then be able to look to that affidavit evidence to see if it showed an imminent and irreparable harm to a significant interest?
Well, I think that the court would presuppose to go back at every step here now to review the facts. I don't think the court needs to do that, but obviously it could be done. I think what needs to be more looked at is the face of that order, and is it invalid on its face? Not are the facts that led up to it sufficient to support the order?
Well, certainly it wouldn't be
That's
very sensitive to expression if the only thing we reviewed was the face of the order rather than looking to see if there was any evidence to support the entry of an order, would it?
Well, Your Honor, again, that puts us in the position of allowing the individual to substitute his judgment for the judgments of the appellate courts and the trial court in determining whether to obey or not obey court order.
Are there any reported cases in Texas that have heretofore utilized the letter bar rule that you're asking this court to engraft in our Texas jurisprudence?
We believe that the case of...
Certainly was not in Ex parte Tucker.
No,
Ex parte Henry.
And we think that Ex parte Tucker is distinguishable again in that it is a content type case.
Oh, that was labor picketing. And labor picketing is different from abortion rights picketing.
Well, I don't agree with that, Your Honor. But
how is Ex parte Tucker different from this case?
Well, Ex parte Tucker placed a total ban upon a particular type of picketing. This particular order placed a ban on any demonstration within a protected zone.
Doesn't that make it more egregious?
Well, no, I think it does not. I think it is content neutral and therefore it is less egregious.
So
in Tucker, the type of, Your Honor?
Do you think that a trial court could enjoin labor picketing within 100 feet of the entrance to the business?
No, I do not, Your Honor. I think that a trial court could enjoin all demonstration within 100 feet.
Well, but when there's a threat of labor picketers and the business goes to court and says, we've heard and here's all our affidavits, this is going to happen, could the trial court enjoin any picketing of that business within 100 feet of the entrance?
Your Honor, I believe they probably could. The issue, though, I think, that is not so much what is in that temporary restraining order, but is in the conduct of the relators and how they treated that order. And this is why I think that we need to look at one Texas case in particular, which is State versus Brzezinski, where this court held that in a case involving a civil action where Dr. Brzezinski was found to have violated an order of a court with regards to the dispensation of information about certain medical procedures, a weight loss treatment. This particular court held that he was not at liberty to violate the trial court's order, even though it was up on appeal had been subject to remand. And in that case, this court refers in its footnote to Dickinson out of the Fifth Circuit, which basically holds for the facts or for the law in Walker that we must be extremely careful. And as a matter of fact, in Dickinson, the Fifth Circuit there dealt with a case that involved the First Amendment basically against another cherished right, which is our right to a just and fair trial. In that case, we had reporters who were ordered by the court to not report any of the proceedings that occurred before that court that day. They did so. Prior to reporting on that, they announced to the press publicly that they were going to violate the order. And the Fifth Circuit, in the review of that case, determined that, yes, this order was inappropriate. It was totally improper, and it was unconstitutional on its face. Nevertheless, the defendants in that case, Dickinson and his companions, were not at complete liberty to disavow that order. As a matter of fact, on remand, the convictions for contempt were upheld.
I interrupted you earlier as you were telling me about what each of these people did. We covered the first four. Is there any contention that the remaining individuals did anything more than that?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. I think the record will show when the court reviews it that there was conduct as well, including some degree of blocking and trespass, at least in the case of Reverend Tucci, that led to the court's finding of contempt.
Can you describe that for us?
I believe that he entered upon the premises of the Southwest Medical Facility, not on the premises, but on the parking lot.
Is this at the West Loop Clinic?
Yes, the West Loop Clinic on the parking lot. Climbed onto a ladder. I believe he took a bullhorn in his hand, again announcing disdain for the court's order. Tore up a copy of the court's order and things like that that constituted more conduct than speech.
Blockade the facility or deny access to anyone, or did he leave immediately?
I don't think the record's clear as to whether he left immediately. I do not believe he engaged in any blockade activity, although I do believe there was blockade activity on that day. I don't believe
but
Reverend Tucci participated.
Not by this person?
No, Your Honor, not by that.
Or not that it is charged that he led or contributed to?
Well,
in this record, I believe
that the court finds that he aided and abetted and encouraged others in disobeying the court order.
Specifically, in blockading the facility as distinguished from entering the 100.
I don't believe that's in the record.
And going back to the test for reviewing these prior restraints, can you tell us on the face of the order why this is the least restrictive means of preventing the harm?
I think this type of test has been, or this type of restriction has been used in other jurisdictions, and I think that Judge O'Neill considered that.
Where?
Well, I believe it's been used in other cases that have been cited in our brief as well as in this brief.
Well, the one on which you rely most heavily is the McMonigle case.
Yes.
And even it allowed participants to come within
some demonstrators within a certain area. Yes, that's correct. But we've got to remember this was a temporary restraining order, and it was subject to modification. And again, to go back, if the relators felt that this was not the least restrictive order that could have been entered, they could have gone back to the court and said, Judge, we think we should follow McMonigle. We should let 5 people in. We should let 50 people in. This they did not do. What they did is they chose to go out and violate the court order. I would yield the rest of my time to Mr. Nann.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. That was the longest 5-minute argument I've ever heard. Since I appear to have no choice, I'll be very brief. In response to Justice Doggett's question, if Davenport applies to the orders in this case, there are actually 3 orders, particularly if the requirement in Davenport that the restraint be the least restrictive alternative, equal protection analysis, if you will, if that applies, these orders can't survive, and I can sit down. Now, having said that and having heard my client gulp, I'll go on to say Davenport clearly should not apply here for the simple reason that these orders should not be viewed as a prior restraint under this court's prior restraint jurisprudence or any other court's. These orders did not prevent anyone from speaking, as does a prior restraint. These orders simply said, you may speak wherever, whenever, and however you want, except in this very narrow area.
Well, that's a play on words to say they didn't prevent speaking. They prevented speaking within 100 feet of the end.
Of course, and that's the essence of any time, place, and manner restriction.
Do you agree with the county attorney's counsel that labor picketing could be enjoined within 100 feet of the gates of business?
Not if it were described as Your Honor has.
It demonstrated. Quote, demonstrated.
Labor picketing?
Yes, demonstrating by labor against business within 100 feet of the entrance to the business.
Depending on how the order was framed, it might.
Just like this one.
If it were content neutral on its face, and if the court had in front of it a record from which it had concluded that there was an imminent threat of irreparable injury, yes, then I think that would be a legitimate.
So if the business came in and said, we've heard there may be shootings, we've heard this could get ugly, we've heard that there are going to be vituperative outbursts against employees who cross the picket line, and we want to move them back 100 feet, 500 feet away from the entrance in order to do that.
Well, as you describe it, no, I don't think that would be a sufficient evidentiary record. Here, the applicant certainly said more than we think we've heard. Another distinction, obviously, is that here, the focus of the activity, I mean, the essence of the activity of the applicant clinics is the provision of services to which people are constitutionally entitled. There are other constitutional rights involved in this case. Whether there would be in a typical labor picketing case, I don't know, but I think the cases are certainly different a bit in that regard. Now, to your other question, every place restriction is a total ban on speech within whatever place is defined. Now, in essence, that's a play on words, but it's a play on words sanctioned for the last 30 years by the United States Supreme Court. Every restriction on the place where speech can occur, and those occur many, many times, limits speech in that particular place. That does not mean that within that zone it is a prior restraint which you therefore analyze under the Davenport rules. If that were the jurisprudence of this court, no time, place, and manner restriction can ever be upheld.
Where would you draw the line between prior restraint and reasonable restrictions?
Well, I think that you'd have to do it in two ways. First, content neutrality, while a key, I think the court probably saw in my supplemental briefing, I concede that content neutrality may not be a 100% predictor of whether something is a prior restraint or not, but it's a good clue. More important, a prior restraint, in every case where this court has found one, has involved a total ban on speech in a large geographic area or on a topic in totality.
So are you saying that if the judge had entered a mile restriction or a 10-mile restriction on banning speech, then it would be appropriate to look at it as a prior restraint?
Absolutely unconstitutional if the judge had done
and
that.
So as we narrow it to 100 feet or 10 feet, whether it's 10 feet or 10,000 miles, it's still a prior restraint, isn't it, that needs to be reviewed in terms of whether it satisfies the requirements for prior restraints?
Respectfully, I think not. No.
Where along the 10 feet to 10,000 miles do you draw the line and no longer need to consider whether it's a valid time, place, and manner restriction?
Well, what the Supreme Court has done, and I guess what this court inched toward doing in the Iranian Muslim case, where it indicated that it would use the same test espoused by the U.S. Supreme Court, in the third prong of that test, the so-called Perry test, the problem that you just pinpoint is dealt with, because the third prong of the test is whether there are ample opportunities for communicating your message that still exists notwithstanding the place restriction. A 1 mile or a 10 mile restriction in this case clearly would have failed the third prong of that test, and this
and that
order
prong,
couldn't have been withheld.
Is not a prong that has been adopted under the Texas Constitution, is it, by any case?
Not under the Texas Constitution, no. It's referred to in the Iranian Muslim case, but then for other reasons the court went on to analyze the San Antonio Ordinance in that case differently because you concluded that it in fact was not content neutral, that it was intended to stop particular speech in all places at all times because of the political content of the message.
You mentioned that this particular restraint is different in nature because of the other interest involved. Is the interest in health and safety of the patients and the right of a woman to choose regarding an abortion an interest that can be properly weighed in evaluating this restraint?
Very much so. Again, we're moving backwards in effect to second prong under the Perry test, acknowledging what Your Honor just raised by question, whether that test has been adopted by this court. The second prong of the Perry test goes directly to the strength of the government's interest and the nexus between that interest and the restrictions that have been imposed in the order. And so, absolutely, the reviewing court should look at what the government interests are, whether they're served by the restrictions that have been imposed.
And why wouldn't the same analysis apply, though perhaps not to the same degree or a greater degree, in trying to ascertain whether there is an imminent and irreparable harm under Davenport?
I'm sorry, I don't follow.
Why would you consider the same kind of interest, if they're valid interest, in determining whether there was a showing of imminent and irreparable harm under Davenport?
Well, you would consider the same interest. The tests are different in that under Davenport, as with a content-based restriction, you would require, as I read both Davenport and the applicable federal cases, you would require a much closer, stronger nexus between the restriction itself and the governmental interest being served. In contrast, in all of the time, place, and manner cases under the United States Supreme Court's jurisprudence, what is required is much less than typical equal protection analysis. Instead, it's simply that the restriction serve the governmental interest, not that it be essential to them or necessary to their realization. Now, if I could clarify just a few other things that were raised by the...
Let's see if there are any questions or clarifications.
Okay, my red light is on, so I'll stop if there are no more questions.
I'll ask you to clarify. Thanks.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
I'm opening the gate.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Doggett asked whether the order was extended. In fact, it was. All three of them were extended by a subsequent order of the court. And as this court well knows, that was the only permissible extension. And when the order extending the orders expired on September 3rd, then all of the temporary restraining orders were dissolved. And in fact, today there is no order in place. The court has withheld its ruling on the application for a temporary injunction and has not yet ruled. Justice Doggett referred several times to whether the violation was the fact that one or more of the relatives had stepped within the 100-foot zone. Just to clarify and reemphasize, the orders did not prohibit anyone from stepping anywhere. It was perfectly permissible under these orders for these relatives or anyone else to be within the 100-foot zone. This was not a place restriction that barred people from entering. In that sense, it was different from the McMonagle injunction, which was far broader and actually prohibited people from being physically present within 500 feet of a clinic. Here, people were free to walk on the public sidewalk right up to the clinic, unless the Houston police told them they couldn't. Nothing in the order itself prevented that. The only restriction in the order...
Then how do you define demonstration? Because clearly, they were prohibited from demonstrating within 100 feet, but now you're saying that all of these three or seven relators could have very easily, under the court's order, been within the 100-feet zone and do and say anything they wanted to unless they blocked the entrance or to the clinic?
No. And say anything they wanted to is very different than be present.
They could be present but be silent.
No, they could even do more than that.
They could be present and have a play card. They could have a picket.
They could be present and do anything other than the specifically enumerated acts which were prohibited.
Not content-based.
Pardon me?
Content-based.
Not content-based, because while they were prohibited from demonstrating, they were prohibited from demonstrating on any and all topics.
Could they be present and come across the street, as Reverend Terry did in one of the videotapes we've been furnished, and have a debate about whether a woman has a right to choice in front of a television camera?
Certainly, and that's why when that occurred, and obviously we knew it occurred, we videotaped it, we didn't seek to have Mr. Terry held in contempt for that. Mr. Slavinic, who was convicted of contempt really at the tail end of the entire three-week episode in Houston, was within 100 feet of clinics virtually every day for a three-week period. Indeed, thousands of people were within 100 feet of clinics every day. But unless they were demonstrating and flagrantly showing their contempt for this court, they weren't in violation of the court's order. And I really do want to emphasize it, because it really demonstrates how the injunction in McMonigal was far broader than the injunction here.
So if somebody saw all this on TV and wanted to take an opportunity to express an environmental concern and walked into this area, they would have been in violation of the order?
Very much so, Your Honor. If they were acting in concert with one of the named defendants, or if they were a defendant themselves. Obviously, the order only applied to people who were subject to it. I mean, if someone from Greenpeace, who was not a defendant and, as one might surmise, not acting in concert with Operation Rescue, came and protested the killing of whales, he probably wouldn't have violated this order, although if it were causing a threat, as it probably would have, to the health and safety of the patients of the clinic, we might have gone and sought to prohibit him from demonstrating as well, simply by naming him as an additional defendant. But the prohibition on demonstrating was content neutral in that it did not seek to define a particular message. And that's exactly what the Fifth Circuit noted in the Medlin v. Palmer case.
But what other message did these people have?
I don't know what other message they had. Again, not trying to be coy or cute. Obviously, Operation Rescue was there to express a particular political message. And I guess Justice Cornyn's question goes to almost a metaphysical issue, where only particular people are subject to a restriction. How can you say that it is content neutral? The courts have looked at that and repeatedly held that time, place, and manner restrictions, which are content neutral on their face and are imposed by injunction and therefore apply obviously only to the defendants who are subject to the proceedings, are still content neutral. Now, if it were otherwise, and I really do understand the question, if it were otherwise, then perhaps Mr. Sekulo would be right, because if every injunction, simply because it applies only to particular people, is therefore content-based, then it will be virtually impossible for any injunction that limits speech in even the slightest way to ever be upheld, because the test for upholding a content-based restriction on speech is much tougher. It's more akin to the test announced by this court recently in Davenport.
Is it correct that the record that we will be getting in this case does not show a violation of this restraining order by any conduct that amounts to a blockade or denial of access to any of these facilities?
That's correct.
And that none of the evidence shows sufficient noise occurring outside these facilities that it prevented their operation inside?
I don't know that that's correct. These were very loud demonstrations, often held using sound amplification devices very close to clinics. There was testimony in the hearing in Houston from one of the physicians that patients who were braving the mob and coming into the clinic had elevated pulse rates, that it took more anesthesia to do medical procedures, and that concomitantly increased requirements of anesthesia posed greater risks of complications, including death. So while clearly the record in this case will confirm Mr. Sekulo's position that none of these seven relatives was blocking a door in some way, It's not clear at all to me that the record would reflect that the noise level did not interfere either with the effort of women to exercise constitutional rights or the effort of clinics to carry out lawful medical procedures.
Counsel, let me ask you one last question from my perspective. I want to clarify or seek a response from you in the statement made by relators in their brief. They allege that one of the vices in this order, temporary restraining order, is it places in the hands of your clients a tremendous amount of discretion for selective prosecution, that you made a strategic decision not to file motions for contempt against Houston clergy that were engaged in identical conduct as these relators. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, we thought we were doing pretty well. We had 11 contempt hearings in about 9 days. There were limitations physically in terms of how many people could be identified, served with show cause orders. It's a very cumbersome process to actually serve people and bring them into court. Now, that aside, if we were to stipulate for purposes of argument that we sat in a room and said, let's pick off the chieftains, which is the allegation that's been made, I don't believe that that would pose any problem, as Mr. Sekulow suggests, under the licensing cases. There, what the courts have focused on is discretion on the part of government agents to determine on a standardless basis without opportunity for review who will be permitted to speak and who will not. In effect, what the court criticizes in those cases is that while a statute may be content neutral on its face, a licensing scheme, a bureaucrat may in effect turn it into a content-based gatekeeping function by giving great permits to people he likes and denying them to those he doesn't. Here, you have a court proceeding, civil court proceeding. Obviously, the only people who can be brought into court on contempt are those who are subject to the order. For one thing, you have problems of proof if you attempt to bring in people who are not obviously closely tied to a defendant or who are a defendant themselves. While there were certainly women and children standing within 100 feet of clinics demonstrating, I, as lead counsel for Planned Parenthood, would have had a heck of an evidentiary problem in proving that they were acting in concert with Operation Rescue. We chose, as every civil plaintiff makes strategic choices, to seek contempt against the people who were most prominently encouraging contempt for the court's actions. It seems to me that both in representing my client and in representing the court as an officer of the court, in seeking contempt charges against the people who are announcing their intention to engage in contempt and indeed encouraging others to engage in contempt, that was a perfectly appropriate decision on my part.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much. Can I mention one other thing before I leave? It's very clear.
You can submit it.
Is there a question? Yes, I make it brief.
Very brief. The Hirsch case, which Mr. Sekulow referred to, and in fact, Mr. Sekulow was the attorney of record in, the Supreme Court did in that case, in an unusual procedural context, a request an application for a stay of a lower court injunction, did speak in terms of using time, place, and manner analysis with respect to injunctions. Indeed, injunctions which, as Mr. Sekulow described, applied to prohibit demonstrations within 50 feet of abortion clinics. Thank you.
Anything else?
Just a few responses. Respondents would have it that an abortion facility is some type of enclave immune from the First Amendment or from the Article 1, Section 8 of the Texas Constitution, and that is just not so. The price of freedom is sometimes in areas we're going to hear things we don't like, we may not agree with, but that's the price of freedom. And if there is this profound national commitment to uninhibited, robust debate, especially in public streets and sidewalks, I would think that it would apply equally to an issue such as abortion as it would to labor disputes and labor picketing. The only other statement I'd like to make is it's really the bottom line analysis is out of sight, out of mind. They could be 100 feet away around the corner so nobody sees them. They could demonstrate and do anything they want. If, however, they determine to enter this 100-foot speech-free zone, They just better not demonstrate. And the court was specific as to what constituted demonstration. And as I said, it was singing, it was prayer. In fact, one thing in the record that we do have available for the court, Judge O'Neill herself stated, it is clear from all the testimony from these individuals here today in the courtroom that the prayer and singing that took place there and the joining together with their friends and persons who had the same goal in mind in going there was directed at their disagreement with the activities that were conducted at Planned Parenthood. Under the clear and obvious terms of the order and the common understanding of the word demonstration, it is clear to me that the conduct violated the terms of this court's order. Our position is that that statement shows what demonstrations are, and it is pristine speech. The liberty to speech was violated here. This is a prior restraint because there are sanctions before the speech was issued. It is our prayer that this court ordered that the relators be discharged.
Counsel, many of my questions to you and opposing counsel have focused on what did happen. Shouldn't our focus instead be on what the judge, rather than Monday morning quarterbacking the judge, looking at what she had in front of her at the time this restraining order occurred? And in that regard, though much of the focus of your press conference seemed to be aimed at President Bush and whether he would change, there were also comments by Mr. White that there would not be business as usual at this facility and that he was hoping there would be thousands of people there willing to risk arrest so that it would not be business as usual. And aren't those considerations that Judge O'Neill could consider in making her decision?
Certainly, and she did, and she instituted a prohibition which we're not challenging today involving the blockade activities. We're not challenging that. We are challenging strictly the speech provisions of this injunction. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are you saying, counsel, that we should not engage in a balance as to the governmental interest in protecting whatever conduct the advocates of free speech seek to inhibit? And I don't mean physically inhibit, but see, by changing the minds of either the people engaging in that conduct at the time or political leaders or society as a whole, that we only look at the speech side of the governmental interest and not whatever governmental interest, legitimate governmental interest may be involved on the other side.
No, we don't dispute that the court can look at the interests at stake. However, it is our position, and I'm weighing that and balancing that, the scale tilts in favor of free expression. Simply our position.
But the fact that the conduct that was being engaged in the clinics is at the current time constitutionally protected should that make some different weight than if that conduct was not constitutionally protected.
Absolutely.
For instance, if it's a church you're demonstrating, that may be different than if it's a saloon.
Correct. However, the
whatever you
year.
Say, the balance.
The balance tilts to the favor of those engaged in the activities. Yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
That concludes the argument in the second call. The court will now take another brief recess.
Notice, please rise.